Avi Morin, Rabbi Dweck, Panas Presidente, Chairman, Executive, friends, it's a pleasure to welcome you over here this evening to be able to hear Rabbi Dweck. Yes, as a community over the last few months, it's been a difficult time for us after what's happened. However, we look for the future, and to be able to see Rabbi Dweck with us, rejuvenated, reinvigorated, is Rav Shem even stronger, is a pride and joy for us, and a pleasure to welcome you back within our community again.
Thank you.
It was only a couple of weeks ago where I should have remained in bed, but I had a choice whether to cancel a young professionals event in London, where we had the youngsters of our congregation living in London to be able to eat and meet with both Rabbi and Rabbanit Margalit Dweck, or to stay in bed. And it was weighing on my mind, and yes, the burger's bowl was quite tempting, but the reality was to be able to be with Rabbi Dweck and to be able to connect our youngsters with him and Margalit was something not to cancel lightly. And I was able to go down to London for it. Those who attended really enjoyed themselves thoroughly, to the extent that a few of our youngsters spent second night Rosh Hashanah with Rabbi Dweck and Margalit. And actually today I got a few text messages from them describing what the most wonderful time they had with Rabbi and Rabbanit Dweck, and to be able to stress to the next generation who aren't just living over here, but living in London, that they have an address, who to connect with, and who to be affiliated to, and who to get inspiration from, it's only fitting that they get it from you.
Thank you.
And Bezrat Hashem, that you can give that inspiration not just to our youngsters in London and the wider community there, but also to us over here. Yeah. Without further ado, wish
b'chavod. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you, Rabbi Yonah. Thank you. Thank you. Kal Kadosh. It's good to see everybody again. Before I begin, I'm going to take away from let's call it the elephant in the room. You might have heard that I was in a few issues earlier, recently. But I have to say that the support, the love, the care that I received, that Margalit and I received over that period of time from Manchester, specifically from our Kahal here in Manchester, you can't know how important it was for us and what it meant to us. And whether it was vocal or not, I heard it both on behalf of Rabbi Amir, Rabbi Shlomo, the Kahal itself. And I have to say that, you know, from before, but certainly from the time that we spent Shabbat at the opening, this Kahal has a very special place in both our hearts. Margalit, she looks very much forward to coming back and spending Shabbat here in Manchester, and please God, we should be able to. But I didn't want for the Yamim Noraim for Rosh Hashanah and Kippur to pass without coming to see you, to spend some time sharing some ideas with you, and certainly being able to say thank you. And really, from the bottom of our hearts, we thank you. And Yehi Ratzon that we should, please may it be God's will, that we should go higher and higher in strength, our Kahal, all of our affiliated Kehilot, and we should celebrate good things together. I want to speak tonight about Yom Kippur as we're facing the day. The Hachamim call this day simply the day. Yoma, they call it in Aramaic, which means Hayom, the day. And it is a day, Ahat Bashana, says the Torah, once a year, that we essentially are supposed to be able to clean up. I mean, that's generally how it is that we see it. I mean, it's a day that we all come together to be able to address whatever it is in our lives that we need to address, that we feel is necessary to address. We stand before God. We say our sorries. There's a lot of standing on Yom Kippur. But I'd like, if I may, to look into it a bit more with you tonight, to try and get a bit more of a deeper understanding of the day. What's the mindset that we are meant to come into Yom Kippur having? What's at the heart of the day? And ultimately, around what do we build everything that we do? So to present it, I'm going to offer this to start with. We as human beings are master storytellers. We love stories. We love stories so much that even when we are asleep, our bodies are asleep, our minds stay up all night telling us stories. And that's been the case as far back as you can go. So when we were hunters and gatherers, and we were trying to find the antelope, which we had to, because if we didn't, we wouldn't eat. We had to deduce where we would find them, how to catch them, and what would be the best tactics in order to be able to get them finally on our table for dinner. And so we couldn't afford, in those endeavors, to make mistakes. And if we made mistakes, we adjusted for them, and we made sure that the next time around we were better at it, and that we were able to catch the antelope. And so we would examine the footsteps, and we would check where it was that they were going, what directions they were moving in, and little by little we learned how to do this expertly. And so there was very little room in that endeavor for stories. We had to have accurate fact in order to be able to eat and survive. But then there were gaps, of course. You know, where did those antelope come from? And where were they when we weren't running after them? And what were they all about, really? And to fill those gaps, we would sit around campfires and tell stories about the great antelope gods. We would draw artwork, put up artwork in our caves about the antelope. And there's a peculiarity about the human mind that has a great need to do this. One of the reasons why we have a great need to do this is because we have to find meaning. We want to be able to have answers, understanding for what it is that we don't know. And sometimes finding those answers is not so easy. So when we are hard-pressed to find accurate answers, which means that hard-pressed means we're not going to eat if we don't find the answers, we figure out the answers because we're pressed to do it. But when we aren't pressed, and when we have gaps that allow for us to fill in answers without having to test them very often, well, we do. As a matter of fact, we are prone to do this without even thinking. We all know this. I'll prove it to you, because I guarantee at some time or another, everyone in this room has had this experience. You know when you're dreaming, you know, you're asleep, you're dreaming, and suddenly there's a sound of some sort outside. You don't know it's outside when you're dreaming, but you figure it out. And so a car might be, making noise, a lorry, whatever it is. Maybe it's your alarm clock. And you immediately incorporate that sound into your dream. You know what I'm talking about? Is it just me? You know what I'm talking about, right? This happens rarely, but it happens. Maybe some more often for some of us. But this happens without us consciously thinking about it, yes? Our brain is wired to make sense of what is unexplained. And essentially, if I'm dreaming and there's some foreign noise that's going on, my brain will make sense of it as quickly as it can. First of all, so I can stay sleeping. But second of all, because if I don't understand what's going on, I am not at rest. And not only am I not at rest, I'm not secure. And so I will find reasons at all costs to calm my mind. And the only time that I will awake in such a situation is when the incongruence of the intruding sound or whatever it is coming into my dream is so severe that I can't maintain it anymore and I've got to wake up. Which incidentally is what always wakes us up. I mean, because there's many levels of sleep and wake, is there not? I mean, you could talk about actually sleeping in your bed and waking up from your bed, and then you could talk about, you know, I've woken up and I've seen things and understand things and hear things that I haven't heard before, paid attention to before. And you know what the thing is about waking up? Once you wake up, nobody can convince you that you're sleeping. You may not be sure that you're awake or sleeping when you're sleeping, but once you wake up, you know that you're not sleeping. And so there are levels of awakenings. And what causes us very often to awaken are incongruencies, things that don't run right, that are so difficult for me to reconcile that I realize something's got to happen. But let's take a step back first. Before we wake up, let's talk about the dream state. Why do we do this? We explain, find meaning, rationalizations for strange occurrences that we don't know the answer to, but we will find answers immediately without consciousness in order that I should be able to remain at rest and secure. Yes, we've established that. Yeah, you've all had the dream experience. So you know that your brain does this, which is very unsettling. Because that means that we don't really know when we're just making up stories and when things are actually true, if we don't test them. So one of the ways that we can tell whether I am making something up or whether it is actually going on is testing. Now let's put that on the side for a minute because we're going to come back to the testing in a moment. But testing is required. It is required because I must accept as a human being, if I care at all about reality, that my mind is an expert illusionist. Expert. Does it automatically, without even thinking about it. It's programmed to do so. And that means that just because I think doesn't mean that I am thinking correctly. Now, when I say that, how do you feel? Think about it, right? I've just made everybody a touch uncomfortable in the room, which, you know, you'll have me back, but I've made a lot of people uncomfortable lately. The thing is, this is nothing. I've just said something that has made you feel a little bit uncomfortable, because what I have insinuated, after proving to you with a dream sequence, right, that I've brought out that everybody's experienced, is that just because we think doesn't mean that we are thinking correctly. And if it is possible that I am not thinking correctly, it means that I have lost touch to whatever degree, could be a very minor degree, could be a great degree, but I have lost touch to some degree with reality. Which means, and this is the scarier part, I could be proven wrong. And you know how we feel about that. We don't like that very much. And there's only really one reason why we don't like that very much, and it has little to do with ego. It has to do with security. That's really what lies at the bottom of it all. Security. Because if I am shown that I could be wrong about what's going on in the world, it means I'm vulnerable. Because if I don't know what's going on in reality, then I will miss something. And it means that I'm vulnerable. I could be affected by things that I'm not aware of in reality. And I can't afford to lose sleep over that. Yes. And so the interesting thing is that my mind is programmed from years back, a lot of years back, to make sense of unsensible situations at all costs. We are not, and here's a key, pay attention to the next line. We are not wired for truth. We are wired for security. And that means that we will prefer an answer, any plausible answer to the true answer, as long as I can sleep tonight with the answer that I've got. Yeah. So, understanding that, realizing that in order for me to be connected aware of, sensing reality to the best of my ability, it means that I have to relentlessly test. So how are some of the ways that I do that? One of the ways that I can test is to use other brains. The way that we regulate our minds is with other minds. So the only organ in our body that regulates on the outside, everything else self-regulates from within, but the brain regulates with other brains. So there's major questions about who it is that we surround ourselves with. The Hachamim talk about this all the time. So what they'll say, for example, is, you know, you should spend time with the Hachamim. Why? You know, just try to think like them. Because if they're genuine Hachamim, they're really testing reality all the time. I mean, they're more interested in what's actually going on than what they think is going on. So spend some time with them. Make your house a place in where Hachamim converge and study. Yeh betcha betvaad l'hachamim, it says. Or it says, harhek mishachen ra, you know, you have a bad neighbor, don't stick around. It influences the way that you think. And that's something that we know. Our surroundings influence the way that we think. The people that we live with influence the way that we think a great deal. There's very little we can do about this. We are programmed to run in society. We are social animals. And so if I'm interested in reality, I'm going to want to find at least someone who will tell me, you're out of your mind. Today, yeah, today, tomorrow, whatever it is, you're out of your mind. Right now, the thinking is not on par with what's actually going on. And those of us who have a friend, a family relative or someone that will do this with us, that we trust, is invaluable to us. Some of us are so uncomfortable with this that we make sure not to know anybody like this. Of course, not anybody in this room. I'm talking about other people, right? We're all very careful about that. But essentially, and the crazy thing is, and this is the beautiful part, is that we can always see other people's insanity much better than our own. You know, I mean, you know, right? Everybody else is out of their minds. But thank goodness it doesn't affect me. Why all of this discomfort? I mean, really, if we think about it, that is the whole of Yom Kippur. It's one day a year where we stand before God. And on Kippur, we stand before God less as the creator of the universe, although, of course, he never relinquishes that title, and more as a king who cares, who we are in a joint endeavor with, leading our lives. In other words, we look at our lives that we are leading as joint endeavors with God, knowing that we cannot do it alone, knowing that we are not the source of our own existence, knowing, and I don't know if you use this term, you know, talk about pulling yourself up by your own bootstraps. You use that? Right? Okay, good, good, good. Remember that. Right? We don't pull ourselves up by our own bootstraps. Our lives are not a bootstrap operation. As much as we might like to think it is, as much as we might like to believe that we are autonomous beings, that we hold ourselves well, and that we are the masters of our own destiny, well, that may be true to a certain degree, but ultimately, we are in this with a partner. And our every breath, and our life and death, and our ups and downs, and our trials and triumphs, all are joint endeavors with the source of all existence, what we call God. I want to pause on that for 1 minute. I haven't spent a great deal of time in Manchester. Please God, I hope to correct that. But there's something very important that we have to understand when I say God. And I'm going to repeat this many times, not tonight. When I see you, I'm going to repeat this a lot. Because without it, there's very little that we can understand. So when I say that we are in a joint endeavor with God, what do I mean by that? Who's God? So the Rambam, Maimonides, he opens his book, the Mishneh Torah, with God. Except that he doesn't say God. It takes him five paragraphs until he actually says God. He will not say God at the beginning of the book. Instead, he uses another term. The term that he uses is Matsui Rishon. Matsui Rishon literally means primal existence, which is essentially another way of saying that which existed before all things existed. That which existed before all things existed. Did you have your espresso before you came tonight? Follow carefully. If I am talking about first existence, that means nothing existed before it. That means that it does not exist in a place, because place would then be first existence, and then that's what I would be talking about when I talk about existence. Incidentally, that's what we call God, the place. We will say, Baruch HaMakom Shenatan Torah LeAmo Yisrael. Blessed is the place who gave Torah to Israel. Baruch HaMakom Baruch Hu. HaMakom Yenachem. And so on and so forth. Talk about God as being the place. We're not the only ones who do this. This is in Latin as well. Dominus comes from domain, dominion. It's all connected, right? So if you have your place, you are in charge of your place, you are dominant over the domain. God is the place. He doesn't live in a place. He's the place. He's the first one. And if He's first, that means that He's also not bound by time. Because if He came from somewhere, then or from something, and He had to have developed in some point of time, then that means that the time was first. Now that's what I'm talking about when I talk about God. So when I talk about God, I'm talking about the first entity. And what that means is, it is not contingent on anything, by definition. Contingent meaning it relies on absolutely nothing for its existence, by definition, yes? Couldn't, because if it relied on anything, then whatever it was relying on would be first, and then that's what I would mean when I say God. So I'm talking about the first thing, yeah? Everybody with me? Good, I'm seeing nodding heads, very good. Very good. And that means that God, therefore, is not contingent. He does not exist in the sense of something existing by something else. Here it is. He is existence. If we could say such a thing. He is the very force of being itself. In Hebrew, our name for God, that we do not speak but we see and meditate on, is Yud and He and Vav and He. Yes? Our Hebrew speakers in the room, how do we say to be in Hebrew? You know? Lihiot. Lihiot. How do you say was in Hebrew? Haya. How do you say is? Hove. How do you say will be? Yihyeh. You know the letters that we use to spell those words? Haya, he, yud, he. Hove, he, vav, vav, he. Yiyeh, yud, he, yud, he. God, yud, he, vav, ke. He is existence. He is being itself. And therefore, in our prayers and in our tefillot, we will say, Vadonai Elohim Emet. Yud, ke, vav, ke, existence, capital E, our God is truth. Well, of course. What else would existence be? I mean, how do you define truth? Is truth not what exists? As opposed to what's false, which doesn't exist? Yes? Okay, so my search for truth essentially is my path to being able to connect to existence itself. Because the more that I frame my life in truth, the closer I am to truth, which means the more I am connected to truth itself, what genuinely exists or what in time is viable, ultimately, what will end up working out, and that way I connect to what we call God. And that is why, if I care not in a religious sense, but in a life sense, about truth and reality, and living My most real life, I care about God. By definition. Now, there are many things that are issues with regards to trying to find truth, because we tend to think, again, with our meat brains, that if I think, it must be correct. And usually it's not the case. We're usually wrong, actually, because we approximate reality in very strange ways. But we're pretty good at testing. Once we get testing, we're doing pretty well. But we also understand that there's very limited elements of knowledge that we can attain with our brains. I mean, with all of the brilliance in the world. All of it. I mean, there's some serious brilliance out there, right? Especially over the generations. I mean, collective thought. It's just staggering. With all of it, I can't even begin to perceive of what a fourth dimension is. Yeah, there's all kinds of hypotheses and so on and so forth. But you immediately feel like you're stretching to the edges of your mind the minute that you have to think about them. This is not just you, Einstein. Maybe he got the furthest, you know? But the bottom line is that if it's not physical and it's not something that I understand in terms of humanity, I'm stuck. We still have never seen an electron. We can't. You know why? Because our light sensors just don't pick them up. That's why. We have very limited capacity to be able to understand reality. So we cannot expect to understand God. All we can expect to understand, at the very least, is our own lives. And try, at least, when we're telling ourselves stories, to test them. And to make sure that we've got them right to the best of our ability. Because otherwise, we are actually living in a dream. And if you think about the Torah, there's only one major issue that the Torah has. Everything else is a derivative. There's only one major thing. And what is that? Worshipping your stories. We call that in Hebrew Avodah Zarah. It's strange worship. So there's only two things. There's worship and strange worship. There's either worship of reality and truth and existence, or there's strange worship. And what is strange worship? Think about it. I mean, what is Avodah Zarah? Avodah Zarah is manufactured in my head, projected out onto reality, and I dance around it and bow to it. I conveniently forget that I've created it, and I worship it as though it's a reality. But here's the thing. Maybe I'm not sacrificing young calves to this stuff anymore. But to what degree are we doing that in our lives? To what degree do you and I create realities? And you know how easy it is to do that. Just indicate it. If you could dream up a reality that quickly just because you don't know the answer to something, and this is in an unconscious state, imagine what goes on in your brain on a daily basis. Or you think, well, I'm conscious, it doesn't happen. Think again. And then again and again and again. We do it all the time. Because we are not wired for truth, we are wired for security. And all foreign worship is only for security purposes, isn't it? I mean, what prompts me, again, what prompts me to make up the stories? Only really one thing, a lack of clarity as to what's really going on. So if I don't have the answers, I fill it in with stories. Sometimes they're really scary stories when I don't know what's going on. You know, in the old maps of the world, before we had discovered everything, at the edges of the maps, they would have sea monsters. You ever see these maps? And it'd say, here be monsters. Well, I don't know what else is there. We haven't discovered it. So, I mean, you know, whatever's there, some crazy, scary stuff. And this is why children tend to have nightmares. It seems like they have more often nightmares than adults. There's only one reason for that. Children are not liars yet, like we are. Children know there's serious things that are unanswered in this world. Somebody has to give me the answer, because if not, I'm in trouble. And so you go to sleep at night, you have a whole bunch of answers, questions that you can't answer. There's a whole bunch of stuff about reality that you have absolutely no knowledge of. And of course there are things, crazy things, monsters and all kinds of things that come out. And then you come in and try to calm them down and say, no, there's no monsters. To which your child says, look, you're the idiot. I'm telling you there are monsters. You have convinced yourself that there's no monster. God bless, so you get a night's sleep. I'm the one living in reality over here. You can tell me that there's no monsters under my bed? You've convinced yourself that there's no monsters under the bed. Everybody knows that there are monsters under the bed. We just convince ourselves and we get everybody else to confirm our ideas, to make sure that we all know and agree. There's no monster, right? No monster, right? Okay, good. No monsters. That's what we do. Which is fine, I suppose, 364 days of the year. But there is one day where we don't do that. There's one day where we all come together to Demons Anonymous. And there is one major issue on that day. And this is what's important. We come together and we stop our stories for 24 hours. And we say, look, we're talking to ourselves and we're talking to God. We do this collectively and we do this individually. And we say, look, God, I'm not going to pretend today that I don't have issues. I've got issues. As a matter of fact, these are the issues, right? We go through the alphabet. Make sure to do it alphabetically. So just in case, you know, there's something standing for something, you know, that I've done in case I've missed it, right? Go down each one. There's Aleph, Bet, Gimel, Dalet. These are my issues. Good. What are you going to do about it? I have no idea. That's not an issue on Yom Kippur. See, people think, mistakenly, that on Yom Kippur, not only am I supposed to speak out my issues, I'm supposed to figure out how to fix the issues too. No, that's what the rest of the year is for. Yom Kippur, I don't even know how I'm going to fix them. But that's not the point. The important point on Yom Kippur is, stop with the stories. Are you going to really? So there's this line in Sefer Yirmiyah, in the book of Jeremiah, where God speaks to the people and says, you want to know why I'm sitting in judgment here? Hineni nishpat otach al omrech lo hatati. I'm sitting here in judgment because you insist that you didn't miss the mark. And that's literally what the word chet means. Sin is it's not the word. I very rarely, if ever, use that word. Not in my writing, not in my speaking. Very rarely, if ever, use the word. What I use is transgression. Transgression simply means there was a line, you crossed it. Now, are you going to acknowledge that you crossed the line or not? Or are you going to paint the line in front of you now and say, no, there's the line? You know, it's like what we do with the bullseye, right? You aim the arrow, you shoot the arrow, way off. And you just paint the bullseye around the arrow. Say, look, I made it. That's denying chet. It's denying the fact that I missed the mark. So how do we feel about people that paint bullseyes around the arrows when they miss the mark? We don't love that. We find it to be a bit of a lacking integrity on some level, don't we? There's a little bit of cheating going on. We never do that, but the other people that do that. But the word chet literally means to miss the mark. It's literally what the meaning of the word is miss the mark. I got in trouble because one year in Brooklyn, I gave an entire Yom Kippur speech about tennis. I love tennis. But I gave it because it's a perfect analogy for the lives that we live. It's all, not doubles, not the doubles nonsense. I'm talking about singles, right? I'm talking about when you're the only guy out there on the court. It's all you, you know? This is something beautiful to be said for team sports, but I'm not now. We're not talking about team sports. We're talking about you. It's you bring everything on that court. And it's just a matter of getting it in the lines. You know Hawkeye, right? That's halakha. No, it is. You think the halakhot are crazy, but Hawkeye, no. That's it. I'm sorry for the people who don't watch tennis, but you understand. I mean, this is such a phenomenal analogy. So what they've got is Hawkeye, right? So if you hit the ball, so you've got Nadal, who's my favorite, right? So Nadal hits the ball to the other court, and he's can't tell, was it in or out? Well, that's a very serious question. Because it either means that I'm in bounds and I'm fine, or I'm out of bounds and I've missed the mark. And do you know how much that ball has to be on the line in order for him to be able to be in or out? A millimeter. That's why they've got Hawkeye. Hawkeye is the Hachamim. You think they're crazy? You know, people thought for years and years and years that the Talmud, with its hair-splitting questions, was so insane. But no, now we've got Hawkeye to be able to check if the ball hit this little part of the line or not. Oh no, it's on. He's in. Do you understand? A person's entire life could change because they missed the line or made the line. It's not a joke. That's halakha. And that's the field we're playing. So a het simply means I missed the mark. Now, okay, listen, you want to be one of the top players in the world? No, I'm okay being, 300th. That's fine. Okay, good. Hazaku baruch. But you want to take the game seriously or not? I mean, at the end of the day, are you going to be playing the game or not playing the game? So what are the risks of pretending when your ball is out? What are the risks of pretending and saying, no, it was in. You can't play. You know what the greats do? You know what the gedolim of tennis do? I'm talking about the great men and women of tennis. They watch their games over and over to see where they went wrong so it can be corrected and they can find solutions. That's tennis. What about our lives? We can't tell stories. At least not on that day. Because it's a question of, well, what does it mean to you? Is it just about getting through, or is it about living real with everything you've got? And if it's about living real with everything we've got, then we have to acknowledge when we miss the mark. We've got to do our best to acknowledge that we missed the mark and say, indeed, I missed the mark. Says the Rambam, those two words in Hebrew are the entirety of Yom Kippur. Aval hatan. Aval hatan means, indeed, I missed the mark. That's what we come to Kippur with. And that's all that's expected on Yom Kippur. And all God says to us, essentially, on Yom Kippur is, are you going to stand here and tell me that you made it when you didn't make it? I mean, are you going to really tell me that you hit the bullseye? I mean, I can see that. I mean, you know, really? Should we go back and look at the footage? I mean, we could do that if you want. Why is this so important? It's not just important because I can't play the game if I'm not truthful. It's not just important because I will find myself living literally an illusion of a life and then wondering why nothing is working for me. Well, if one doesn't know the coordinates, how are things supposed to work? It's not just that. Having a foot in reality is the first step to rehabilitating. Because there is a world of difference. I'm not talking about fixing anything yet. Like I said, I stand by this. Yom Kippur is not a day for fixing things. Yom Kippur is a day for coming clean and acknowledging things. Can't even begin with that. And that, by the way, is the last day of Teshuvah, not the first. The first day is just assessments. Rosh Hashanah is a Yom HaZikaron. It's a day of memory. It's a day of assessments. Kippur is Ketz. It's the end. It's the ultimate. Right? Ne'ilah, and the gates are closing and so on and so forth. And all of a sudden, we're not going to be listening anymore. And there's more. Fine. Whatever have you. Ultimately, that day is about coming clean and recognizing I made it, didn't make it, and I'm not going to pretend today that I didn't make it. I'm going to say before you and for me that I didn't make it. So as I was saying with Yirmiyah, the Pasuki says, I'm sitting in judgment because you said you didn't do anything. So the Malbim has a beautiful reading on that pasuk because it's a strange Hebrew. It doesn't say Hineni shofet otach, I'm judging you because you said. It says Hineni nishpat otach, which is reflexive, God speaking, saying I'm being put on trial because you said you didn't do anything. So you put me on trial. What's the issue? Think about it. It is a massive difference when someone is out of touch with reality and they know it, as opposed to someone being out of touch with reality and not knowing it. And I'm being politically correct here in saying out of touch with reality instead of insane. Right? But there's all levels of insanity. Because what's the definition of insanity? It's just that a person is not in touch with reality. So just the question of what level we tolerate, right? I mean, there's a threshold. Certain levels of insanity we allow to run in society. Certain levels of insanity we just don't. You know, in certain levels you call the men in the white coats and they take people, you know. It's just a question of what's our threshold. How much non-reality do we accept in the people that are around us? Well, I'll tell you one thing. One thing that we all intuitively know. It is tremendously less severe when the person out of touch with reality has a sense that they're out of touch with reality. Consider the following scenario. You are in Jerusalem. Please God, right? There's a lot of crazy people in Jerusalem. So you're in Jerusalem, and the strange thing is that in Jerusalem there is a syndrome, a psychological syndrome, right? That is unique to Jerusalem, called Jerusalem Syndrome. I don't know if you've ever heard of it, right? What's Jerusalem Syndrome? Jerusalem Syndrome, strangely enough, people who live in Jerusalem for a long, they tend to think that they're the Messiah. And so they get a Messiah complex, right? They actually believe that they are now chosen by God to be the Messiah, okay? So there's you and then this guy, okay? You're walking down the road, and this guy comes over to you and says, excuse me, I have something very special to tell you. I'm the Messiah. I'm Mashiach. You want him now, I'm here, right? So let me talk to you, right? What do? You tiptoe away from the person, run as far as you can in the other direction. But what if this is what happens? What if instead of the person saying, he says, look, I've got a problem. Maybe you can help me. I wake up every morning thinking I'm the Mashiach. Now, I know that's preposterous. I mean, it's crazy, but I can't help it. I mean, I keep thinking that I'm the Mashiach and I'm planning things. And so, do you have the number of a good psychiatrist? To which you, of course, say, of course I have the number of a good psychiatrist. You know. Much less threatening. No? Why? Because you know that they have one foot at least in reality. Which means that you share a world with them. That's really what it means. You can identify with them because you are in the same world, at least on some level. And that is why it's important on Kippur. Because we have the option of either standing in front of God saying, look, I'm the Mashiach, I don't know what your problem is. And I'm here, you know. Or you could say, look, Ribono Shel Olam, I'm a mess. Whatever level of mess, right? I'm a mess. We all are. I'm doing what I can. Yes, I made a mistake here. Yes, I missed the mark on that one big time. You know, this one was a little off. I needed Hawkeye. It turned out I was out, right? I'm not going to pretend and tell you that I didn't miss the mark. Good. So you know what God says to that? We're sharing a world. That's lovely. Because I thought you were in another world. And I was in one and you were in another. But at least we're sharing a reality. And if we share a reality, then we have what to talk about. Great, I'll see you next year. It would be nice if you come tomorrow morning, but look, at least you're acknowledging that you never call, you don't write, you don't tell. Fine, at least you're acknowledging it. I miss you, but still, you know, I mean, we have our times. That is the essence of Kippur. On Kippur, we don't tell the stories. On Kippur, we stand up bravely and we say, look, I'm not going to pretend today. that I didn't mess up. I messed up. And I acknowledge it. And yes, I am fighting every fiber in my being to tell you that. Because I am prone, you know, you made me, so you know this. I am wired to make up stories to protect myself. I am wired to rationalize the things that make me uneasy, whether they're things that I do not understand or they are things that I have failed at and do not want to come to terms with. I will, without thinking, make up the story, and I will believe the story, and I will worship the story, and I will hold the truth of that story intact in my mind and heart at all costs, until I cannot maintain it any longer. That is our struggle in humanity. And unless I have to eat the antelope, I will find a story to fill in what I don't know. But once it is essential to me that I've got to know the truth, I figure it out, interestingly enough. I figure it out. So I want to end with this point, because I think that this is a very important one. And although I've spoken about this on Yom Kippur many times to many people, this part I have not really emphasized. And so this is its debut for you. And it is this. Our lives and our missing of the mark is not about willpower. We make a big mistake. We think that it's all about willpower, and it's a question of how much discipline I have or discipline I don't have. It's really not about willpower. It's about what is real to me and what isn't. And what I know I can afford and I cannot. And how much something matters. Because you know what the interesting thing is? Once we make our mind up about a particular reality, we do it. It's only because when we say we've made our mind up, we've got one foot outside. Any time that I make my mind up about something and I am in the domain of what it is that I'm going to do, we don't let it go. I mean, I've seen this. I grew up in Los Angeles. There was one man in the synagogue. He was a smoker. He was a major smoker. Right? He decided on Shabbat he wasn't smoking. And the amazing thing was, Shabbat came in, and Shabbat went out, and he was fine. And I asked him, like, are you suffering? Oh, no, it's Shabbat. But he had locked in his head that during that period of time, it just wasn't an option. The minute Shabbat was over, there was a cigarette in his hand. Lit cigarette in his hand. The minute Shabbat was, I mean, it was like he literally, he wanted to know when Shabbat was over, you asked Marco. But during that time, it wasn't an option. And there are those situations in our lives when we decide emphatically that this is now my reality or this is no longer my reality, it becomes our reality. You know what? It's phenomenally fascinating how well we adapt as human beings to circumstances that change. There's only one reason we struggle with willpower, and that is because we haven't decided. Once we decide that my reality, whatever it may be, big or small, is emphatic, that this is it now, it's it. You don't do it anymore. And the proof is always in the pudding. You need to get up early in the morning. Well, it all depends on why you're getting up early, doesn't it? I mean, I used to know people who love to fish. I don't know if there's any of those in the room, right? Love to fish. And by the way, you either like love fishing or you just don't fish. There's no, I've noticed, there's nothing in between. It's not like you casually go fishing. You either like are an insane fisher person or you don't, you know. So, you get up early. You don't miss that one. You got a plane to catch? You get up. You don't miss that one. Maybe you do. I mean, it depends on who you are. But that all depends on how important the flight is. But at the end of the day, the strange thing is, and this is the funny thing, there are mistakes we don't make. And do you know what determines whether we make a mistake or not? And this is the most uncomfortable thing. But we're humans, and so we have a little bit of slack. But you want to know what determines whether we make a mistake or not, really? How real is it to you? Nobody forgot to get dressed coming in here this morning, this evening. Why don't you forget that? I mean, we forget a whole bunch of things. That, for some reason, we don't forget. Kriyat Shema, to say Shema, that we don't, that, you know, it happens, you forgot. What are you going to do? You know, you forgot this, forgot that, forgot this. Forgot my anniversary, forgot my birthday, forgot the birth, forgot all of that. You don't forget to get dressed in the morning. Unless you're insane. But it's all a question of a spectrum, isn't it? It's just, how insane are you? That's all, it's the only question. And it's the only question, it's the what level of reality. We don't forget to get dressed in the morning because the reality that will hit us in the face the minute we walk out the door is so powerful, you don't forget that. But there are other things that are negligible. And so we do. And we allow for ourselves room. And so the question is not willpower. The question is, how emphatic is the reality to us? And are we willing to acknowledge the reality or not? So you know what the good news is? Yom Kippur comes every year. It's not like a one-time thing, you know? It's a one-time-a-year thing, but it's not a once-in-a-lifetime thing. And we are expected to grow, as we do with our lives, and year after year, acknowledge the things that we need to, that we were deceiving ourselves about. Yes, it's a strong word, I know, but nonetheless, on whatever level. And as we get older, and we become more knowledgeable, and we have greater experience of life, we awaken. If we allow ourselves to awaken, there are times, and there are people, and there are situations in where we fight waking up at all costs. We always lose out when that's the case. Because life then and the world then runs by us without our consciousness, without our capacity to interact with it. But for the most part, we grow and we awaken. And as we awaken, we see things that we hadn't before. And we come face to face with realities that we thought were otherwise. And that's the moment of truth, literally. When we come face to face with the realities that we had originally thought were otherwise, how brave are we? How much do we care about reality? And you know what? At the end of the day, that's the question of how close do we want to be with God? It's not a religious question. It's an existential question. To what degree do we wish to be connected to the source of all being? The path to it is truth, to whatever degree we can find it. And yes, the truth is relative, and yes, the truth is in terms of perspective, but the reality is that there is testing that we can do to help us extend beyond these cocoons of bodies that we have that are self-contained. Testing. So the Hachamim will say, get yourself a friend. At all costs, literally, at all costs. It's a k'ne lecha haver, buy a friend, whatever you can do. Get a friend at all costs. You can't survive in this world without one. And we're talking about a real friend. We're not talking about yes men, right, that are going to tell you that everything is fantastic because they're protecting themselves. They're not caring about you. They're worried about who you're going to love them or not. Well, that's not the friend you need. You can have those, but that's not the friend you need. Or havruta or mituta. It's either that friendship or death. Why? Because we don't have connection to truth and reality otherwise. At all costs. The greatest people we have known in our human history, the ones that we celebrate for what they've contributed to humanity, to our understanding of a world, are people that on one level or another did not compromise with their commitment to truth. We talk about Isaac Newton. By the way, you should read this fantastic, if you're interested in him, you know what I mean? James Gleick, fantastic science writer, wrote a beautiful biography on Isaac Newton. It's old, it's been around for a while. You read about Isaac Newton, I mean, basically, Isaac Newton, until we started to discover subatomic physics, he basically mapped out all of the physical world for us. He was an unbelievable genius. I mean, done. It was done. Newtonian physics. It was just he had described it. He figured it all out. But the guy used to stick things in his eye, you understand, to figure out light. What light? Well, he literally stuck stuff in his eye so that he would be able to figure out how his eye worked. And that's just one page of the book. The greatest people in our history, my beloved Rambam, Maimonides, the man was a relentless truth seeker. You'll see Hachamim write to each other, arguing about law, about philosophy, about ideas. And they will write, there's beautiful Hacham, he wrote to his friend, he says, you know, I love you very much. Aval ha'emet ahuva alay yoter, but truth is more beloved to me. And so I'm going to refute what you said. So on one level or another, that is our endeavor. To connect to life. To connect to truth. And Kippur helps us. It cleanses us. It cleanses us in its own magical ways, whatever it is. But that's not my business. My business is to discover how we engage with the day and help ourselves through it. And the one thing on that day is, don't come with the stories. Just say, I missed the mark. Hatati. Hatati. Did it. And with that, first of all, we leave with a weight off our shoulders. Because it's remarkable, speaking out something of truth, even if it's the truth of my own mistake, is tremendously liberating. But it also allows for me to step firmly into a reality that I can live in, that is viable. And what ends up happening in our life is the more that we do that, the more we're prone to do it. And it helps us. And we discover that year after year, we genuinely do. It may not be an easy road. It may not be a comfortable road. It may be rocky, difficult. But it's real. And you can take it to the bank. And so with that, I wish everyone Shana Tova Mvorechet. Tizku L'Shanim Rabot, Ne'imot V'Tovot, Gemar Hatima Tova. I hope, please God, that I'll be able to come back and see you. But thank you for coming out tonight and spending some time with me before Yom Kippur. It was very important that I come to see you before the Yamim Noraim, and I hope to make it a habit, Bli Neder. But I wish you a beautiful, sweet, blessed year. You, your families, the entire community, the Hachamim, Rabbi Zelitu, Hashem Yishmerem V'Chayehem, and the Parnasim, and the people that are leading the community and helping. May it all be blessed with God's grace and goodness. Amen.
For some questions.
Yeah.
We have a few minutes for questions, but before the questions, first and I thank the Joe Dweck Charitable Family Trust for hosting this event. We have, after the questions, a beautiful media reception where everyone will be able to enjoy and also have an opportunity to continue to speak with Rabbi Dweck. And also, there is a vigil taking place outside the Islamic Center on Grove Lane, where anyone who can attend the last quarter of an hour from 8:45 to 9:00, there was a terrible thing where one of the leaders of the community was stabbed last night. And if we can show our communal support and empathy to the terrible things that takes place of religious hatred, so please take the opportunity to do so. Please, when asking, there's literally time for maybe three or four questions. We ask not to ask questions on the past.
You could ask that at dinner.
You can ask that later on, but certainly on the topic or something connected to Yom Kippur or the Chagim.
Yes.
I'll talk to me afterwards. Yeah.
How do we, thank you very much. How do we know that what is in the Torah is the truth and not stories? stories for our security?
There is only one way that we can know that, and that is experience. That's the way that I think. The only way that we can know that is through experience. Now, it's true that you can have faith that it is and test it. Yeah? So to me, the testing is in the years and the experiences. Our people and in my own learning, right? In other words, my own experience. So there's two things that are problematic with experience. One is I can't share it with you because it's experience. So that's all I know. And the second is that it is something that I also, in terms of myself, can't really articulate. It's hard to articulate it. It's only something that I can ultimately hold in terms of my mind. But experiences are downplayed, unfortunately, very much today, because if we can't speak it out and write an algorithm for it and so on and so forth, we tend not to trust it. But our experiences are very important. The highest things in humanity are essentially experiential. So you talk about love. It's experiential. You could sit and talk about all day long about the chemicals that are firing in the brain. You can talk about, you know, show two people in love and see what it is that happens between them. You can talk about the psychological effects. But at the end of the day, if you haven't been in love or felt love, you just don't know what it is. So there are two elements to Torah. One is experiential in terms of the learning. And two is, I think that we, I mean, you know, this is me. I'm answering from me. I'm not answering, you know, this is the way that we answer the question. For me, Joe Dweck, why does Torah speak to me in terms of truth? Not only my own experience of the learning, but to me, the very fact that it has been the guide for our people for three millennia, that a book that was meant to be a personal guide to a Hebrew tribe in the desert ended up emerging as being the light of the world and the foundation of two of the world's greatest religions beyond Judaism. I mean, to me, that's nothing to sneeze at. And its viability, to me, is its greatest monument. The very fact that you and I should be sitting here tonight, 2017, 5778 Kippur, you know, coming around the corner, as Jewish people, still speaking about that book, still slaving over the words of that book, still applying the words of that book to our lives. I said this when I was speaking with Rabbi Sachs in New York. Moses could come down 100 times and split the sea. It would pale in comparison to the reality and testimony of that truth. So that's what it is for me. Can I prove it to you? I don't think that I can prove it to you. But I don't ask you either to take it on faith alone. I think that there's something very powerful to be said for the existential longevity of what it is that that book has provided for the Jewish people. And I don't think that we would be who we are, we wouldn't think how we think, we wouldn't engage in the world the way that we do without it. So that's all I can offer you. Yeah. Good. Okay, you got it all. Excellent.